Ali, welcome to Radio Autonomía. It's great to have you here in the studio with us. So you're originally from Turkey. Your family lives there still. But you've been living here in the U.S. and specifically in the Bay Area for many years now. But we know that you just came back from Istanbul. So tell us about why you went to Istanbul last month.
Well, as maybe the listeners are already aware, there was a kind of very large-scale countrywide rebellion that started at the end of May. And I was here kind of glued to my screen for the first week. And then it became more and more clear that this was a very momentous event. And there was no way I could not go and experience it and take part in it for myself. It was a bit of a spur of the moment, but I knew that if I hadn't been there to take part in this rebellion in my hometown, I would have regretted it for the rest of my life. So I went there and met up with my friends and comrades in Istanbul, and it definitely was a life-changing experience.
So that's, you know, what we hear about here is the story that this was a rebellion that started in Gezi Park on May 31st, but it quickly exploded into something much, much bigger than a movement to save a park, right? So if you can tell us a bit about how you saw things evolve, both from here before you left and once you got there, and why you think that this rebellion gained so much momentum so quickly, because it truly exploded.
Right. So before answering the question, one thing I think that should be clear is that obviously it became something much, much more larger than saving a park very quickly. But also initially it was not about saving a park. Yes, the park was a focal point and people were trying to stop the development of that particular park. But it was kind of the latest in a series of campaigns geared towards preventing all different kinds of enclosure around the city. So the same people involved in saving the park were also involved in defending other public spaces from capitalist development, such as for example, there's a large-scale campaign against different gentrifying schemes for different neighborhoods in Istanbul. So Istanbul has seen this great development in the past 5-10 years, which is fueled by this influx of foreign debt and is kind of a way that the government is delaying the effects of the financial crisis from 2008. So yes, it was about a park, but in fact it's more kind of in defense of the city and to preserve the city as a place or to transform the city as a place for people rather than capitalist development. So what happened was that it's very telling for those of us involved in social movements and organizing and who are, you know, looking to kind of spark or be part of large-scale urban or other kinds of rebellions. When the first initial two bulldozers came to the park to remove a few trees, the response was a couple dozen people. It was very small, and knowing the people who were there, they, you know, were kind of just going through the motions of, fighting this more to like take a stand rather than, you know, to spark some sort of large movement. Nobody could have anticipated this. Still, everybody is completely bewildered that something like this took place. And then every day that followed, it kind of grew tenfold. And then tents started coming. And then there was probably around a few thousand people when the police came and evicted it on the morning of May 31st. And so when that happened, the one important factor was these certain images of the police pepper spraying people in the park and also burning people's tents who were there. And that was disseminated very widely through social media and principally actually through Twitter. And so that happened. And then after that, people met up around midday to have a press conference about what had happened, and that was 500 people or maybe 1,000, again, very small in comparison of the days to come. And the police attacked that. And then what happened was that suddenly there was this incredible energy, especially in this one neighborhood where all of this is taking place, which is the neighborhood of Beolo, which, to put it into context, is kind of like the young cultural area of the city. So there's already this kind of undertones of counterculture and social antagonism. It's also an area where there's a lot of bars, and Erdogan's AKP government has kind of attacked alcohol consumption because of their Islamist backgrounds. So there's already this hostility towards government in that, towards this particular government in that neighborhood. And suddenly, people always point to the 31st as the day when everything changed, because there was 50,000 people that just appeared out of nowhere, not because there was a particular call to meet somewhere at some point. And then it quickly transformed into a whole countrywide rebellion. And basically, it was a convergence of many different segments of society that had been repressed for a long time. So it was extremely heterogeneous, and it kind of created a place for people to come to meet their common enemy, rather than to converge under a particular point, a program, or something like that. So a lot of people came, you know, the park and urban renewal was one thing, but, you know, there was participation from different leftist groups, from minorities, from the Kurds, also some more nationalist tendencies who saw the erosion of the secular country. So all these people came together and actually gave birth to the space, especially in Gezi Park, where they were able to talk with each other, and there was this huge personal transformation that happened, actually.
So I just want to back up a second, because you sort of said very nonchalantly that 50,000 people just showed up.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no call, nothing like what we saw, you know, in Egypt, that people say that there was a call for a time and a day that people would arrive, you know, interior. There was no call put out. So how does that happen? How do 50,000 people just show up?
I think, you know, one thing is that this, you know, the 31st of May was a Friday.
Okay.
And the 1st of June, where things continued, was a Saturday. And this, the weekend is already a time when this neighborhood is just flooded with people. That's where you go to hang out.
Okay.
So that was a part of the reason. People were already there, and they had already reached a threshold of tolerating police violence. Because that street is also where most marches in the city take place, mm-hmm. and the police attack it. And so people witness these things all the time. But that, I think, in conjunction with Twitter and people texting each other and like getting the word out, kind of brought people to the streets, and it continued for 2 days. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, it got this character that was beyond itself almost. And people just started to feel, you know, I think the more people saw other people in the streets with them, it gave them confidence. Mm-hmm. And they started inviting more. It was like, oh, we're not alone, actually, anymore. You know, the isolation was broken through, and that brought a lot more people into the space.
And so it wasn't necessary to have a specific call to come out under for a certain cause, because everybody sort of felt, it was sort of an awakening of everybody's sense that there was something to stand up against, something to fight for, something
right.
to reclaim.
And really, it's this visceral hatred of the prime minister, of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and also of the police.
Okay.
You know, so that was the unifying force. What everybody can agree on is probably that, you know, that they really hate the prime minister and they really hate the police. And then after that, there is very different kind of trends and tendencies within the people who are part of the movement.
Okay, so that antagonism with the police was the most immediate thing that was happening
for sure.
on the street.
And the images of the initial attack
right.
definitely enraged people.
And so, you know, speaking of these images, this is what we were seeing here, right? We were seeing images of, you know, the really, really brutal repression that was happening on the streets of Istanbul, of Ankara, and the other cities where the rebellion was occurring. And so can you tell us a little bit about what you saw on the streets? You know, the images that we see have been sorted through and picked through either by the person posting them on Twitter or by the media, you know, mainstream or alternative. So what is it that you were seeing on the streets in the days that you were there? And how would you characterize the state strategies and their techniques of repression and violence?
Well, one thing I think that is really lost in when these images get transmitted through the internet is that people in the street were not afraid. And not only were they not afraid, but they were also having a really good time. It was like this joyful rebellion where people were laughing all the time. They were cracking jokes. A lot of the chants were making fun of the police. There was this explosion of graffiti. There was not that you couldn't find space to put up more graffiti, and the vendors in the street were actually selling. You know, they would sell, you know, helmets and goggles and gas masks, and they would also sell spray paint. And so there was no space left, and the graffiti was this incredible, satirical, and with all these kind of memes of popular culture and the internet, and it was this very humorous thing. And by the time I got there, especially, I think on May 31st was when that the kind of fear was broken. People would, you know, for example, you would march up to the police line and you would chant for the police to tear gas you. And in this kind of soccer stadium melody and spirit. Uh-huh. And then eventually when you would get tear gas, before people would retreat, and there wasn't really any running, people would just retreat slowly, they would first cheer the tear gas. You know, it's like, yeah, we got the tear gas. And it was this kind of masochistic thing. You know, I saw one spray paint that said, "Don't you have it in strawberry?" You know, referring to the tear gas, you know. So that was definitely the vibe. And people would retreat calmly and everybody was very chill. And then there would be these barricades that were set up that people would defend. And then when the police came through the barricades, people would kind of spread out into the side streets and then converge again on the main street and do it again for hours and hours and hours. I saw this happen for, you know, almost 2 days with a little break in between. And I think also Turkey has never seen this kind of rebellion or uprising. There has never been riots, the kind that we're used to in the United States or in other European cities. The police haven't had to do, crowd control in the classical sense. What happens in Turkey is usually these appointments with the police, for example, on May Day, where both sides gather their forces, and then there's, you know, very intense and violent clashes, you know, much more than we're used to seeing in the U.S. But it's kind of choreographed almost. And, there's, before this, what could be seen as rebellions was neighborhood, it actually that participated heavily from their own neighborhood in this most recent uprising called Gazi Mahallesi, which has its own history and a very important memory there from this rebellion that happened in 95. That was a multi-day uprising of a neighborhood. That was 95. And then before that, I would say that maybe, and I'm just talking about Istanbul right now, in 70, in June 14th and 15th, there was a big workers' revolt. So these aren't things that happen very frequently, and I think the police are not used to dealing with a whole zone of the city fighting and being in an uprising together. They're much more used to isolated blocks of people. So it took them a while to actually figure out how to deal with it. And I saw their tactics improve over the time, you know, because first they would just push people off the street and then expect it to be over like it usually is. But because of the tenor of the and people's really, ferocity and just the will to keep on going, people would just scatter into the side streets and then converge again. So while I was there, the police started to move into the side streets and actually prevent people from going onto the main street. And they also started to, for example, search people's bags and arrest people on if they found a gas mask and things like this. And change some of, you know, the primary thing that they used was tear gas. But they would use the tear gas as actual ammunition. 13 people lost their eyes. There's more than 60 head traumas from tear gas canisters. There's 5 people who died, some of them from getting hit by tear gas canisters. And then they would also use these water tanks, which, you know, if you've been following, you've seen them because they're these kind of medieval-esque, like tank things that basically are water cannons. And then on the day that they evicted the park, they started filling those with pepper spray instead of water. And that was definitely pretty freaky. But so, you know, I think that probably the Turkish police are going to definitely think this over and try to come up with some strategies of how to actually respond to a widespread popular urban rebellion rather than like a fight with militant leftists.
So you mentioned people being arrested, and we saw, you know, reports of huge numbers of people being arrested. What's the state of the folks that were arrested? Are people still being held?
Right.
Are there people, I assume, that are unaccounted for?
There's close to 3,000 arrests throughout the 4 weeks, and of those 3,000 arrests, there's 100 people who... Like an arrest, when I say arrest, I mean detention. Mm-hmm. So they're taken off the street and maybe they spend a night or two in the jail. And then out of those, 100 people actually have charges and are still in jail. During the clashes, there was definitely reports of people being missing and like not being able to be located. But I haven't heard anything of that nature recently. So I'm hoping that everybody's been kind of found. And what happened was after some of the main clashes, because there was this barricaded zone around the square, and after that was taken, and after the park a week later was also evicted, there started to be all these house raids. And they're still going on. You know, every other day there will be an operation early in the morning to raid people's houses. And the state went principally after three kind of segments of the actors, the political actors in the uprising. One of them was just kind of, you know, because they have the addresses and the information, they went after the militant left groups and they arrested a lot of their members. That was probably the largest group. And then they went after people who were tweeting not because they had some sort of help from, you know, Twitter in San Francisco, but because people just were using their real name on their accounts. So, you know, there's a lot of learning that is going to happen, but because people have never had this kind of experience, they just have their Twitter account, and they just tweeted, you know, what was going on and stuff like that. So those people got raided and arrested, and then a third group that was also on the receiving end of state repression was leaders of one of the main soccer fan clubs, Çarşı. So there was a heavy participation from one of the fan clubs of Beşiktaş, which is one of the three main soccer teams in Istanbul, and they're called Çarşı, and they have a history of being political. They would never say this because we're apolitical. But they participate in May Day and in other anti-war demonstrations, and they'll open up banners in the stadium. And they're very well organized. They're a three-decade-old fan club, and they have a lot of experience acting together from the stadium. So they were kind of the main fighting force in the streets. And they, you know, whenever they would show up, people would kind of have a sigh of relief because, you know, you knew that there was a group of people to put up with the police violence. And they raided a bunch of their leaders. And I'm not sure, but I think two of them are still in jail. Yeah.
So, you know, the kind of repression and the outrage that it provoked in those of us far away that were watching the videos and seeing the images, this was always quickly in contrast with the awe and the excitement that we felt as we saw, you know, images of these barricades, and as we saw these masses and masses of people in the street, and people that clearly were not organized to be there together, but were just finding themselves, in some cases, just, you know, fighting alongside each other because of the sheer number of people that were out there. So I'd love to hear more, a little bit more. You've already talked about this some, but a little bit more about the kind of organizing. You know, the use of barricades is something that you mentioned, but how were people organizing on the ground? And especially given the persistence and the kind of stamina, right? There was like just this sense that it was just this ongoing thing, and that, you know, people were not sleeping, people were not resting. It was just on and on and on. we know, you know, that you're no stranger to excitement on the streets, right? And so I'd also love to hear how what you saw, how the strategies for organizing compare with things that you've seen here in Oakland or in other parts of the world.
There wasn't really any organizing.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so...
the wrong word to use.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, there's, you know, the one kind of organizing body, which actually a lot of the people who were... Well, okay, to rewind a little bit. After the park was taken on the 1st of June, many barricades were set up around that zone. Probably around 30 on one street, there was about 16 of them. So all of the main streets and the smaller streets coming into that zone had barricades on them. And then people found themselves in the park and didn't really know what to do. And then they just started putting up tents. And then there was, it basically grew and grew and grew. And certain groups, you know, for example, the LGBT community in Istanbul was very influential in the, both in the street fighting and in this commune that was created in the park in Taksim Square. You know, they had their zone. The soccer hooligans had their zone. Different political tendencies had their zone. The Kurdish political party had their zone. So people just kind of carved out spaces in the park and started to live together and experience that rebellion together. But there's one group called Taksim Solidarity, which was a group that for a couple years now was opposing the plans to develop Gezi Park. And at first they had around 60 different groups, some trade unions, some political organizations that were part of it. After the rebellion, now they have 120 because everybody wants to be a part of it. But, you know, they have some sort of legitimacy, maybe, in terms of having been fighting this development of the park for a while. So, but, you know, for example, the prime minister eventually had to meet with them, and they came out of the meeting not... you know, exactly endorsing, but saying, okay, there's this idea for a referendum about the park. We think this is a positive development. But, you know, to their credit, they definitely did not try to impose that decision on the people who were occupying the park and were part of the commune there. But instead, they said, we're going to have a series of meetings. So there are all these, there are these seven forums around the park where people were to see how they felt about the referendum. And across the board, people said they, you know, what referendum? We don't want it. This is our park. This is, you know. And it was kind of this negotiating that was going on. It's like, okay, we'll give you a referendum and you'll leave the park and stop occupying it. And people were definitely not willing to leave because they were saying that, you know, we haven't won anything. Why would we leave? So the organizing was extremely informal. But, you know, there are different groups that were heavily participating who are very well organized. So every group would, you know, take part in a bit, you know, a certain factor of the uprising and do it. In terms of an overall organization, it definitely did not exist. But, you know, for example, if I was to, you know, compare it with Oakland, I think that one thing I realize is that, you know, in the U.S., we lack these, like, collective forms of life. You know, we might have these political ideas and groups and organizations and stuff that are, you know, really cool and on point, and I believe this personally, but there's like, a very, like, the culture is poor in the U.S., you know, so everybody's individualized and atomized from each other, and so... You know, whereas in Turkey, where there wasn't a lot going on and everybody was really dismal about the political situation, when it exploded, it had all these factors of, you know, the soccer stadium or the nightlife, where people are already have an experience of being together, and that transferred very well into the streets. In, you know, the experience of living in a barricaded commune for 2 weeks changed people's lives forever. Things that you would never imagine, such as Turkish nationalists spending time with Kurds in that commune and then being completely ashamed of their previous political identity and apologizing. Or, for example, Here, you know, the three soccer clubs were there together, people who usually kill each other if they see each other on the street. There's one story which I think is pretty cool, is that the beginning of the rebellion, there was a lot of, because, you know, it's widespread, everybody, soccer fans, so there's a lot of anti-women, sexist and homophobic and anti-sex worker chants and graffiti that was going on. And after the first few days, there's interventions against this from different feminist groups and queer groups. And my friends told me the story where one day they were at the offices of one of the LGBT organizations, and a delegation of Çarşı, this Beşiktaş fan club, soccer fan club, came in and said, you know, we're really sorry because we've been using these words all our lives. We didn't know better. Now we know. And then they also had brought them a police shield as kind of a token of apology. You know, so these kinds of things happened over and over. And I think that is one of the most valuable things that people came away with. You know, finally being in the, you know, in the absence of the state, when you're barricaded yourself against the state, you really realize why these social divisions are, you know, are there in the first place.
Wow. Where do things stand currently? You know, you've been back, what, a week or so?
Mm-hmm.
What was the state of Istanbul? What did the city look like, you know, as you were leaving? And how do you think that the city and more generally the society has been changed by this? You know, you pointed to some of that
right
just now in your last comments, but...
What happened was after the park was evicted, actually, again, out of the kind of initiative of Çarşı, they said, okay, we're going to, you know, people can meet at this park because they have a neighborhood that they're named after, that the soccer team comes out of. And they said, there's this park in our neighborhood, come there. So there's a few hundred people there, and then in the amphitheater, just talking. And that idea quickly took hold, and now there's something like 35 popular assemblies. It's called forums in different parks around Istanbul. They still have a few hundred people. The biggest ones have, you know, 300-400 people attending them each night. At the beginning, there were thousands and thousands of people there. So it's kind of the... Even though it's been evicted from Gezi Park, it's found different locations and points to be present around the city. And a lot of times those assemblies, you know, if something happens in Turkey, I don't know if there's, you know, for example, there was this attack on a Kurdish march where the police opened up fire, the military police, and killed an 18-year-old. There was marches from all these forums in solidarity with the Kurds, which... would have never happened a month ago. Something is going to happen in Kurdistan, and then there's going to be multiple marches of solidarity in Istanbul from people who aren't Kurdish. Or, you know, a newspaper will publish something egregious about a person who was killed during the uprising. They'll decide to have a march. So it's kind of more, you know, it's not, it's, there's no decision-making structure in the sense that decisions aren't being made in name of the whole forum of the assembly, but people will get up and make proposals, and if there's enough interest, people will do it. So also what's been going on is the Taksim Solidarity, this umbrella group, has called for every Saturday to meet at Taksim. And yesterday, actually, because they won this court case where they which meant that the construction, the development in the park and all of Taksim was actually illegal. So they said, okay, we have this court decision, we're going to go to the park. So they made a call for thousands of people to meet and enter the park. And that, you know, of course, turned into a battle that went into late at night. And then they're going to attempt to do the same thing tomorrow. What's happening right now is also on the 9th is the beginning of Ramadan, which is a, you know, relatively difficult time to mobilize people to take political action in the streets. And there's the government. What happened was after people were evicted, the city occupied the square and the park. So the park is filled with police. And actually, the first thing they did after they planted trees in the park. kind of as this, you know, PR move. And so now they're going to open the park, and they're probably going to try to, I mean, we'll see what happens, but they're probably going to try to paint it in this kind of religious Ramadan zone and, like, get all of their supporters to be there. We'll see. We'll see what will happen. But I'm pretty confident that the original aspirations of Erdogan, of the prime minister, to develop that park into some sort of, you know, Islamic, architectural, neo-Ottoman shopping mall will not take place after this point. But there's a lot more that, you know, people are still digesting from this rebellion, and we'll see where it goes from here.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing some of your experiences.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's great. And so, yeah, again, this was Ali talking with us about his experiences in Istanbul.